Welcome, everyone. I am delighted you're here with us for another summer special. We are having so much fun this summer, and I am thrilled to have Adrienne with me today. I've been waiting to talk to her for a long time. She does such amazing things, and I'm just so excited to talk to her. So welcome, Adrienne.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Well, we are excited, and we're just going to jump right in. One of the things I always like to start with is, I mean, you're so immersed in history, and in my mind, I just naturally always see you in the history world. But what was it that brought you to the world of history, and especially to the Tudors?
Well, I just have always loved history for most of my life. I mean, I can't even remember what specifically drew me to it in the first place. But I had a really kind of difficult childhood. And so I was a huge reader, and I would just get lost in these stories. And, you know, I remember reading like Island of the Blue Dolphins as a kid. Mm-hmm. And there's another writer, and I'm totally blanking on what her name is right now, but she wrote a lot of young adult books that were set. Like, there was one set during the Boston Massacre, and one set, you know, during, it was another time period, I don't remember, but like, I would devour those. And so, in school, my history teachers were always my favorite. I always loved those classes, and I really kind of started to idolize them a little bit. And so I wanted to be a history teacher, and I went to college, and I started a program to be secondary education, social sciences. But what I found was that my classes just did not prepare me for being in front of kids, for teaching, and for being able to manage a classroom. And I'm kind of a pushover. So, you know, I actually did go into the classroom to observe. And it was one of my teachers from high school who I absolutely loved. And he was a veteran teacher, like 20 plus years of teaching. And even he could not control his classroom. And I thought, oh, I'm in trouble. I can't do it. There's no way me, this 21-year-old who was like super meek, is going to be able to do it. So I ended up, like, I was literally just about to student teach. That was the next thing I had to do, because I had done everything else in the program, and I switched my major. I ended up getting a minor in community service and my major in liberal studies, because I had all, you know, I had all the economics and political science and history. I took every history class except for one that my school offered. And so I just switched to that. But I was always super interested in history ever since then. And so I would read a lot of historical fiction and history books. And then how I got into the Tudors was, of course, how everybody gets into the Tudors, the other Bullen girl, like anybody else ever or spot. And I haven't left since. So here I am.
Oh, that is great. That is great. So I'm going to just ask about a few of your novels, and because there's always like a twist, which I love, and I love the attention you spend on the research. So we're going to talk about that separately, but I want to talk about your first novel, and you need to help me make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Okay.
Because I always, in my head, it's always Corotto. Is that right?
Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, I call it Corotto, but I don't know Latin.
Okay.
Which is what it is. It means brokenhearted in Latin. So I think you probably are saying it right.
Well, I don't know. But anyway, it's Catherine Carey. And one of the things, and you can talk about the novel, because it's just this amazing story of a real person. And that's what I love, is these are real people, but you question some of the assumptions. So the title comes from, so Catherine and Elizabeth I, who is not queen when she first writes that letter, right? Or is she queen? Right. She's not queen yet.
She's still princess.
And so Catherine has left, like other, the term Protestant doesn't mean the same thing, but we sort of use it. So other Protestants have left during the reign of Mary the First. And Elizabeth and Catherine are very close. They're cousins and they're very close. And Elizabeth is saying she's brokenhearted to have Catherine gone. But there's an assumption on when that letter is written that people have just sort of taken for granted. But you question that. So tell us about what it's like, because you do this research and you have all these reasons to question it, but just sort of take on an assumption.
Yeah.
Sort of adopted without any, you know, any definite reason. So tell us about that. That just seems so exciting as an author.
It really is amazing. I love finding these little treasures. And, you know, I had something similar that I found when I was researching Raven's Widow. So when we talk about that one, I can, again, kind of tell you about that story. But with the Corrado, you know, it is dated. It was found in William Cecil's papers, and it was dated by Cecil himself as at 1553. And so, you know, the tendency is to believe that that was when it was dated. And I do actually think that it was dated for 1553. But the more that I started looking at what was going on in Catherine's life during that time, I mean, she was heavily pregnant. We know what pregnant women in the Tudor period, like, they were kind of kept locked up and confined,
right?
You know, towards the later portion of their pregnancies. And this would have fallen right in that time period, you know, so there's just no way that Catherine would have been going on this really, you know, dangerous kind of mission. And one of the things that I kind of discovered as part of this is that we always operate under the assumption that these people left because they were really scared of Mary, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there definitely is a part piece to that. But what I found in my research was that, you know, William Cecil was kind of working with like Robert Dudley and with Elizabeth and the people that supported her to really go across the continent and learn how to set up these churches. So, and Francis Knowles, Catherine's husband, he was a part of this group, and he was really close to William Cecil. And, you know, Cecil basically sent him over there to really learn how to establish these churches, how to worship in the Protestant or Reformed way. And so if you look at it that way, right, if they were really terrified, then obviously they would take the risk of taking Catherine over. But even when they did go, and she is noted as being in Germany in 1557, so this is 3 years later, she actually is referenced. I know where they stayed, who they stayed with, and what members of the family, you know, they left some of their children back in England when they went. So to me, that wasn't the story of somebody who was really scared, right? So you would, if you were scared, you would take that risk. Even if you were heavily pregnant, you'd take all of your children and you would go. But they didn't. And it's actually documented who was with Francis when he went on his trip in 1553. And it was their eldest son, Henry. There's no mention of Catherine. So it was pretty clear that Catherine did not go. But I started to really think about what was the atmosphere then, because people were being burned. You know, there was some, you know, some fear, and all these people are coming and going. And I love the story of Catherine Willoughby when she's going over to Germany, and she just has her whole train, like almost her whole house, and she's just like tromping across England, you know, bold as you can be. And so we have this narrative that people were so terrified they were leaving under the cover of night, you know, right. But that just was not true. Some people probably were, but it certainly wasn't the peerage people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just was kind of thinking about this, and I thought, how easy is it that, you know, Elizabeth is under the assumption that Catherine is going, right? I mean, it would be so easy for her to think that. And maybe there was a plan that Catherine was going to go, and at the last minute, she didn't. So I do think that since, you know, Cecil himself dated that letter, and he would have been best placed to know, I do think it was in 1553, but it could very well have been written in 1557, when we know for sure that Catherine did go. And who knows when he dated it? I can't remember things I did 2 weeks ago.
Right. Yes. And you certainly know if Cecil's looking back and he's remembering that Francis was there in 1553, he might have thought, oh yeah, that's when they all came over, forgetting the details, because his wife was with Francis, which does make some sense. You know, that was the way Cecil was experiencing, because he was working with Francis.
Yes.
And I love that idea that it wasn't so much a flee and hide. It was a go and prepare the continent and how we can work with the continent. I mean, it was very strategic.
It really was. Yeah. And I found a lot of evidence for that. There's this really, really great book called The Marian Exiles by Christina Garrett. And, you know, I have found so much information in there. It breaks it down by who actually went over there, what settlements that they went to, all of these different things. And then, you know, and this book was written, I think, in like, I don't know, maybe the 30s or the 40s. Wow. It's a really old book, but she had done so much research that I was able to track down. And she was the one who put that idea into my head that, you know, this was very strategic. This is what they were doing, because I had never heard that before.
Right.
And so, you know, I followed her citations. I looked at the primary documents, and sure enough, there's these letters from Cecil, and he's talking about what his plans are and who is meeting and who, you know, all of these different things. So I think that oftentimes we are so quick to dismiss something that's really old. Cause I mean, look at Agnes Strickland, right? Her book is very skewed and very, you know, because it was written under the Victorian period and
right.
So, you know, and we want to dismiss her because it's so old and it's so dated, and we want to dismiss these books that were written in, you know, 1539, but there are really some hidden gems in there if you take the time to look at it and follow up on this, you know, sources.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's really great, and a really important point that sometimes we've layered on some assumptions. And I think the one just about why people are going, that it was all out of fear, and it wasn't all out of fear. There certainly was some, of course, you know, there were people getting burned, but there were also those who, you know, for business reasons and all kinds of reasons, just saw that their life would be better on the continent for a while. So I think that's really great. The other thing I love about this, before we move on to the next book, but love about this is this relationship between Elizabeth and Catherine. And the notion, because we often are given portrayals of Elizabeth as being cold and distant, especially with women, right? She's a big flirt with men, but, you know, not kind to the women who serve her. And we hear these stories about she broke somebody's finger, and we kind of get that version. But there were also real friendships and a family connection here. Yes. So can you talk to us just a little bit about that family? Because Elizabeth didn't have a lot of family, but you do see these close ties. And I love this female friendship that you see in this particular relationship.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of it was the things that I read after Catherine died. I mean, Elizabeth was inconsolable. She wouldn't even come out. Like, there were diplomats there who wanted to see her. She would not even come out of her rooms. She was not, you know, and so, and you look at, I actually translated the funeral role for Catherine Carey, which was super exciting. Oh my gosh. I still can't believe that they asked me to do it. Seeing the people who attended this funeral and seeing the amount of money that Elizabeth spent on it. You know, it was just really obvious to me that she lost somebody who was really beloved to her. And towards the end of her life, you know, there are these letters, because Francis was over in, I think it was Kimbolton with Mary Queen of Scots. And he's writing these letters back to court, and he's writing letters back to Catherine. And, you know, he very much treats Catherine, and he calls her basically like the other half of me, and which is so sweet and so kind of unique for the Tudor period to have that deep of a love connection.
Such a love marriage.
And he's basically, you know, treating her as though she is his equal when it comes to Elizabeth. Like, anything that he wants, he has Catherine speak to her. He has Catherine relay it to her. She gives her messages that are hard for her to hear. And there's just kind of this really emotional connection. And even in the way he's like writing letters to Robert Dudley and William Cecil, and the way that Cecil and Dudley talk about Catherine back to him. Like, Robert Dudley, he talks about how, you know, he's chastising Catherine because she's not eating and she's not taking care of herself and she's not doing all of these things that, you know, she's running herself ragged. And so, you know, you don't really see Dudley talking about other women in that sort of intimate, really, way. And so, you know, if you look at all these extra little pieces of the puzzle, you see that, like, obviously Catherine was right there with Elizabeth all the time.
And that's just a really wonderful thing to think about. And I think that also pushes back at some of the assumptions about Elizabeth, and, you know, but it's really warm relationship. And I just think Catherine inspires, because her relationship with Elizabeth is unique among some of the, I mean, Elizabeth is close to some other people, but she has this great relationship with Catherine. And then the marriage between Catherine and Francis is just off the charts romantic, especially for the time.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I loved one of the letters that I found. He was so mad at Elizabeth, because Elizabeth could be, I mean, she had two Moody, you know, I don't think she was cold hearted. Like, I don't buy into that narrative of her, but she could be really moody, you know, and we always hurt the ones that we love the most because we know that they're going to still love us back.
Right.
Even,
right.
You know, it's, right. And so it was almost like Catherine was kind of this safe place for Elizabeth to just really lose her cool and just, you know, and she must have at some point, she must have done something, or it was that, you know, because she wouldn't let Francis come home.
Right.
And that's another thing that I found so wonderful is that Elizabeth literally said, I'm sending Francis because every man I send to marry Queen of Scots gets charmed by her. They all get taken in by her and then they want to support her. And like, we're sending Francis because he's so in love with his wife. He is never going to be
that's
charmed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was true.
Yeah. Yeah. But Francis did write, there was this letter where he wrote back to Catherine and he was just livid with Elizabeth. It was just, I don't care. We're leaving court. We're going to go out to the country. I don't care how poor we are. We're out.
It is great. I've read that. And it's just like, this is a man who loves his wife, who wants to be with his wife, and who will walk away from this amazing career because, you know, the career's keeping him away to succeed in his career. He has to do what Elizabeth wants and she wants him there and Catherine at court. But it is, it's a great, like, we're out of here. I love that. You're right. That is a great letter.
How successful Tudor men, right, are going to leave their careers for their women. That just does not happen because typically they're marrying somebody who is helping them.
Right.
You know, promote their career.
Yeah.
They make these dynastic marriages and that's what they're looking for. And yes, like in many ways, Catherine did help promote, you know, Francis's career because she was so close to Elizabeth and possibly right. Elizabeth's sister. Right. Mm-hmm. So even if it wasn't a love match, it was still a good dynastic sort of marriage. But the fact that he was like, I'm out, I don't care, we'll be poor. Because Tudor men did not want to be poor.
Right. No, it may not have started as a total love match, but it certainly grew into a total love match. And that's great. Yes. And that's probably a good transition because the next novel is about a marriage that, again, I think we've made a lot of assumptions about because, yeah. And we all think it's totally not a love match, that there's no happiness there. So tell us about starting that. What got you interested in that? What drew you to that story? So tell us all about that.
Well, read Julia Fox's book about Jane when I was researching Corrado. And, you know, so I definitely made sure that in Corrado, she obviously wasn't perfect, but she was much more sympathetic than I think you usually would see. But then, you know, I went back after Corrado came out and I was kind of thinking about who I wanted to write about next. And I ended up picking up Julia Fox's book again and really reading it. You know, I had just kind of skimmed it beforehand and, you know, just got what I needed and didn't really like wholeheartedly dive into it. And so I started reading it and it was right about the time I had had hysterectomy. So I was home and, you know, I was really emotional because, you know, you're dealing with those feelings of like, wow, this chapter of my life is over. I don't know if I'm ready for that. It was medically necessary. So I'm sitting at home being, you know, very emotional and very in pain and just kind of not feeling myself. And so I picked up Julia Fox's book started reading that again. And of course, and the reason why I picked it up was because this happened at the end of January, early February, when we're seeing all those posts on Facebook about Jane and Catherine's execution. You know, and so I'm reading this book, seeing all these things about her and dealing with my own internal struggles with not being able to have any more children. And I just really, I don't know, I connected with her in this sense of, here is this Tudor woman, and what is the one job of a Tudor woman? Have children, right? Sure. Have heirs. That is like the one thing, like, you had one job.
Yeah, right. That's very much a, you had one job for a Tudor wife. Yes.
You know, and she, for whatever reason, we don't know, that did not happen for her and George. And I've started thinking about this, you know, the fact that George was the only male child in that family. He was the heir. He stood
to the whole Boleyn future. Yeah, right.
The whole Boleyn future. They were rising at court. You know, he had this just like legacy to inherit, and he didn't have any children to inherit it. Right. So, how did that weigh on him, and how did it weigh on her? You know, the pressure, and, you know, there's studies talking about how when there's high stress, high anxiety, all of these things, it does make it more difficult to conceive children. And then I'm reading in Julia Fox's book, and she's talking about all these, you know, diplomatic missions that George is on, and how the, based upon their religion, there were certain days of the week they could not, you know, have sex. And there was, you know, and so she kind of was like breaking down this, you know, okay, well, maybe they could have here, or maybe they could have here, you know, but George is sleeping in the king's room most of the time.
Right. That's the other thing. George's career has skyrocketed. You know, as Anne Boleyn becomes more important to the king, so does George. And so that takes him away from his wife.
Right, right.
You know, even in terms of location, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we really based this idea that they had a bad marriage largely on the fact that they didn't have children. You know, mm-hmm. Everybody tries to come up with this reasoning for why Jane would have hated George enough to testify against him, which she didn't. I mean, we have no proof that she did.
Right.
You know, and so they trace the root, that is the root cause. And so I thought, well, what if they just couldn't have kids?
Yeah.
Right. What if for whatever reason the dates didn't line up, or perhaps she had gynecological challenges, or maybe he did. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, we really don't know. And, you know, and it's possible. And I mean, this is just something that just came to me as I'm talking to you. But, you know, we talk about how, you know, Henry maybe had Kells, or, you know, Anne was, I think it's the R.
Yeah.
R negative.
Yeah.
You know what,
yeah,
I'm talking about.
RH negative.
Right?
Yeah.
RH negative. Yeah. So was George RH negative? If Anne was RH negative, was George, how does that affect? I mean, this is something that just popped into my head, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to go look at this. Is this something males can carry? You know, I mean, so it could have been George. It could have been it could have been any number of reasons that they right. didn't have a child. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was because they hated each other. And there right. are a lot of Tudor marriages where they did hate each other and they still had children. So,
yeah, those two don't necessarily go together.
Yeah, for sure. So thought, well, if we remove that, mm-hmm. what else is there to say that they didn't like each other? Well, there was nothing. I could not find anything. And instead, I just found instance after instance after instance that Jane really actually was in favor with the Boleyns. And she put herself on the line a lot of times for them in support of them. And Anne kept her close. You know, Anne put her in her coronation procession right by her side, in a place that she was actually not entitled to be. Mm-hmm. You know, even her sister, Mary, she's in the back of the line. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. But here's Jane, front and center, right alongside Anne. And so I just thought, you know, this to me seems like it seemed very far-fetched that they hated each other, that she hated the Boleyns, that she, you know, so I just dove down the rabbit hole.
Right, right.
Where I, you know, landed.
And that's great, because you do see, I mean, that conversation about the king not being quite as manly as he would like everyone to believe involved Jane. If there was all this animosity between Anne and Jane, would you be that honest with someone you hated?
Right. You wouldn't. You wouldn't.
I just don't think so. So that's great. And it brings Jane as a character, as a person, into a different light when you see her as part of the Boleyn family, part of the close family. Rather than as she is often cast as sort of the outsider, never able to get in.
Yeah.
So I just think that's really interesting. So now we're going to just take that notion of seeing people in a different light to another Jane. So I think that it just turns out to be another Jane, but I think that's really interesting. And it turns out to be Anne Boleyn again. So in your newest book, The Keeper of the Queen's Jewels, there's this different way of looking at Jane Seymour and also Marjorie Horseman. So we need to talk about both of them because they both play this important role. But I was particularly intrigued by your considering Jane Seymour's response to what happens in May of 1536, because we, of course, focus on Anne and the horrible, terrifying, you know, just things slipping out of control so fast. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. But part of that is no one believed that Anne would actually be executed. I mean, just no one believed that going in. Chapuis, even her enemies did not believe that would happen. And you bring up the notion that, of course, that was likely Jane could not believe that would happen. That was just inconceivable. Yes. So I do think I would love to talk about that because I've never looked at another book that considers Jane's response to that in that way. It just usually starts with Jane and the king after they're married and then alludes to, oh yeah, they were together during this time, but never really focuses on her watching May. And what happened, and knowing as things just go completely out of control, that's the person whose place she's going to be taking.
Yeah.
That, and she saw Anne as the beloved, you know, for so long. And look what's happening to her now. And you want me to take that. So talk to us a little bit about that. Cause I just was so struck by that when I read it.
Well, there were a couple of things that really fed into that for me. So I actually decided to write about Jane Seymour because I was not ready to let Jane Boleyn go. Like, I was still thinking about her. I still think about her and still research her even now. And it's, you know, that book has been out for years. Like, she's kind of my Tudor bestie, I joke. But you know, so as I started, I was researching Jane and Marjorie, and it originally was supposed to be, the story was supposed to be about Marjorie. But as I started researching her, I was having trouble actually finding anything about her. We literally know like maybe 3 or 4 things about her, about Marjorie, and that's it. And so I was having trouble really kind of trying to put together a story. But as I got to actually getting ready to sit down and write, a few things were happening. So we already had the Me Too movement that was going on. And we're seeing these really powerful men like Henry Weinstein?
Mm-hmm.
Harvey, that's it. Let's see, Henry Harvey. And I started, as these things were like coming out about Harvey Weinstein, I kept picturing Henry. Right. In my brain, I just kept connecting them, and I could see Henry doing some of those things because he was kind of a, you know, he was kind of a creeper with women. And, you know, so that was happening. And at the same time, as it's, you know, all these women are starting to come forward and really talking about the hidden abuse, right? We think of domestic abuse as being a hit or a push or something physical. We think of, you know, seeing a woman with bruises or, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. But really, domestic abuse, the scars can happen inside, and they can, you know, in your mind, and they can be very manipulative. They can be very narcissistic. And then at about the same time as we are coming into the coronavirus, I discovered my husband was having an affair. And at the time, there was like a pretty big stretch of time between me really kind of discovering it and him, of course, denying it and us getting to a resolution where we're going to divorce. And in that time period, there was a lot of, you know, I was being lied to a lot. I was being very heavily manipulated and gaslit and all of these things. And of course, to be quite honest, if I wasn't observant and knowledgeable about what was going on in the world as these stories are coming out, I likely would not have seen what was happening to me.
Okay.
You know, and because he was so good at it, right? Mm. And he was like that person that I trusted fully, and I believed, and I, like, it was just so completely out of the blue. And to this day, a lot of our friends are just like, what? Like, I still can't believe this happened. I thought he was like devoted to you, you know? And so I just became aware of what was happening to me and how easily that happens, right? It doesn't take a lot of effort when you put your trust into somebody, you know, it doesn't take a lot of effort for them to manipulate you and to get you to believe what they're telling you. And so after like the divorce was final and I got settled because I had to move and sell my house and just all of these things, you know, we split custody. And so my son would go and stay with him for half the time. And while he was gone, I just became super introspective and trying to figure out, because I needed to unwind this. And it didn't start with him. I mean, growing up, I was manipulated and gaslit a lot. I lived in an emotionally abusive home. I, you know, grew up with a lot of trauma. And so I started kind of unwinding all of these pieces. And I started to see so many of these things in Jane, in the way that Henry would treat her, in the way that Henry would gaslight her and make her believe that she was wrong. I mean, Who can read that exchange of him you know, her going to him and dropping to her knees and saying, you know, your people are hurting because of what you're doing.
Right.
You need to fix that. And she's begging for them. And he just slaps her down, tells her, you know, you better watch your step or you're going to end up just like the woman before you. I brought her up and took her down. I can do the same to you. And just imagine that happening in the, like, in front of everybody.
In front of everybody, right.
And you're the queen and you are supposed to be this idealized version of a woman, right? You're mm-hmm. you're saintly almost. Mm-hmm. You can't be, you know, people can't touch you.
Right.
You have to have this aura. There's, yep. you know, and he just, in that one exchange, he just wipes that whole thing away, you know, and she has to rebuild that reputation and rebuild that, you know, and I saw a lot of sort of trauma responses in her in yeah. how she was so like strict about what her ladies were wearing down to the number of pearls
right.
that they put yes. in their outfits. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like to me, do you think Jane actually really cared about that? No, but it was all about rebuilding this mm-hmm. idealized version because, you know, that's how a queen is supposed to be seen.
Right.
But we've seen Henry tear down the queen before. We're seeing him tear her down. And right. so she's caught in this crossfire of this is what I'm supposed to be. But how do I do that when I'm constantly, you well, know?
And two, at that point, she also realizes even if she's told herself to believe that Anne must have been mm-hmm. guilty, he's just made it very clear that Anne wasn't guilty, that he just got rid of her because she annoyed him. I mean, right. so that also must have shattered any thought that I'll be okay because I won't do what Anne did. Because right. it's obvious Anne didn't do what he said Anne did, you know, and exactly. that must have been just so exactly. terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it just really, I thought about the emotions I was going through. I thought about the emotions that other women talked about going through. And I really started to see some of that stuff in Jane. And mm-hmm. I thought, you know, I think we have her wrong. You know, I really mm-hmm. do, because Jane would have to be really cruel to truly think that it was okay that Anne was murdered. Like, right. she would have to be really cold-hearted to have influenced the king to kill her, to have thought that it was okay. You know, we love to blame women, you know, mm-hmm. and so Jane right. she gets blamed like, oh, well, she charmed the king and talked him into, you know, no, like that did not happen. And, you know, and as I could see from other things that Jane did in her life,
right.
and especially during her short reign, she was not cold-hearted.
She was not.
Yeah, she was really kind and she was really caring. She cared about the people that she ruled over. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that I kind of like demonstrated that, and I haven't seen it in another novel, and that's part of why I wrote that in there, is the scene where, you know, she's the petitioners are coming in to see her. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. that did happen. You right. know, we read these fiction novels and the queens are always like, it's like they're enmeshed in these dramas, right? But we never really see the day-to-day life mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that, you know, the boring administrative
right, stuff, right, right, right. Yeah.
So I wanted to put that in there to kind of remind people, like, you know, these people have jobs. They did. Yes, they had jobs. Right. It wasn't all glamour and glitz and you know, buffets and dances all the time. They had these really day-to-day jobs, and it just gave me an opportunity to show, you know, that Jane really did care about her people and she wanted to help them in the best way that she could. And there are quite a few examples of her. She just sends some deer to the chapel singers and you know, she does all of these things. And I think it's just really endearing.
Right. And I think too, because she gives Henry a son and then from then on, he loves her, right? From then on, and then she dies, right? You know, so immediately.
Yeah.
And since no one else gives him a son, then she becomes his favorite wife. But I'm not sure at the time it felt like that to her because he was saying terrible things and, you know, talking to people about, oh, I would wish I'd met you before, you know, and also just if you look date wise, Catherine of Aragon got pregnant really quickly. Anne Boleyn got pregnant really quickly. It takes Jane months. And that must have been terrifying.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I cannot even imagine. And of course, because of that, that's probably what took so long. I mean, she was under a lot of duress, really.
Yes.
You know, a lot of pressure. And I feel like Henry was just constantly kind of reminding her.
Right.
So in my book, I have him touching her waist a lot and, and kind of, you know, these little just things that, you know, I'll always remember.
There's no question. She would have always known what her one job was for him. And, okay. So you've alluded to, that's so great. You've alluded to your research. And that's one of the things I love about your books is, and also I've heard you talk about this, how important the research is to you.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about the way you go about your research, how you do your research, all that kind of thing? Because I think sometimes people forget how much research goes into nonfiction.
Yeah.
And then how much research goes into fiction as well. So, you know, you don't even understand how much goes into nonfiction. And then you think, oh yeah, well, fiction's easy. You just make everything up. But not at all true. So tell us about the research that you do in your novels, for your novels.
So, I mean, I try to get into as, you know, as much as I can. I try to go to the primary documents. I've gone to the British Library and, you know, I've held George Boleyn's book. I have done, you know, all of these really great. I went to Wolf Hall and I had tea with, you know, Edward Seymour's nephew of however many times. You know, I love to go and be in these places where people are because there's such a vibe there. You know, there's such a I don't know, like the history energy, it really lends to the research itself. You know, and then and sometimes when you go there, you can see things, certain things that wouldn't be possible, right? So it's just really interesting to me to discover all of you know, the things that you can't get from reading documents. But at the same time, you know, I've probably gone through British history online for like, I don't know how many times, you know, reading through all of the documents and pulling out, you know, and sometimes it will, you know, lead you to going and finding more details because the people who put those together, the editors, you know, they mistranslated stuff and they left stuff out. And sometimes it's just like a summary of the document. So then you have to go and actually find the document. That was the thing with Marjorie Horseman. is that, you know, I actually had to find her letter to Cromwell because it was just kind of summarized in letters and papers. And so, you know, I had to request it from the archives and, you know, do all of that stuff, which I found so fascinating to actually see the letter and you see the fold. So you could see how she folded it. You can see how she wrote her handwriting. You know, and I think that that really tells you a lot about a person. And, you know, one of the things that was really funny was I saw the inventories of Henry VIII and in the folder, there was letters and a bunch of other things, but there's this letter that Reasley wrote for him. And you could see Henry just like he's scratching things out and he is writing things on top of Reasley's handwriting. And it's just, it's been so funny to like discover that stuff because you can just see how bombastic he really is. And he just wants things done his way. Yeah.
Well, that's really true. And I think sometimes as you look at documents, you can see by the handwriting when somebody's upset and when they're calmer and being more deliberate. I found that with some of Elizabeth's that I've been able to see. And that doesn't come through just in a transcript of the letter. So the emotion that is behind that, because their handwriting changes, you know, or something changes and it's just so cool. And I just, I love that idea of, how important it is to get as close as possible to the documents themselves. And so I really appreciate you sharing some of that because I think that's great. And you know, sometimes I think, oh, if I just lived in England, right, I could just make appointments and go to these places all the time. But it is, you know, you have to make these trips and plan things and, you know, try and cram a whole bunch into a trip. So, as a reader, let me thank you for all the work you do on your research because it really does just makes the novels really sing because you can count on the research. The stories are wonderful and the characterization is wonderful, but it's built on a really solid historic research foundation. And I think that's what makes them so powerful. So I also wanted, and I know you talked, you just sort of mentioned it kind of in passing, that you were able to translate something very special. So just as we sort of wrap up the research, can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think that's such a cool story.
Yeah. So I actually made a connection at Grace Court, which was Catherine Carey's home. And, you know, I reached out to them and said, I've written this book about Catherine. I really would love to see her home. I'd love to see her, her tomb at the church that's down the road. And so they, you know, connected me with a historian who gave me this just brilliant tour. It was so great. And, you know, we kind of talked back and forth to each other. She's like part of this Gray's Court history group. And anyway, she, you know, ended up reaching out to me a couple of years ago and she was like, you're never going to believe this, but one of our members discovered this, you know, this funeral roll, but, you know, we're having a hard time kind of, you know, doing the transcript. Do you want to take a look at it? And I was like, yes.
Yes, please.
Does the Pope wear a funny hat? Yes. yeah, so she sent it over to me and, you know, we spent some time like piecing it together. And it was great. Like I loved, you know, really seeing all of these people who attended the funeral. And then also because we could discover how many mourners there were, we could kind of, you know, Dr. Kristen Bundeson and I kind of put together this like idea of when exactly Catherine was probably born, like what part of the year, what year, and you know, it really kind of turned into something a bit scientific. But so it was really interesting to find that information out.
I just think that's so great because to me that is just this community of scholars working together. And I just love that, you know, you reach out to them and then later they reach out to you and you can collaborate. And it's just, I just love that story because, and I think that's also a testament to the dedication you have to doing the research, that you're really going to the source and continuing to go to the source. So I just love that story. So thank you for sharing. That's just a little indulgence for me because I love that so much. Well, before I let you go, can you tell us, are you working on anything special now? And where can we follow you and keep track of what you're doing?
So you can follow me on, I'm on Instagram and I'm very friendable on Facebook and I have a website. So it's adrian-dillard.com. And then of course you can always go to graylondonpress.com, which is the publishing press that I established with author Sandy Vizzoli. Mm-hmm. And then you can just search my name on Instagram or Facebook.
And I'll have all these links in the show notes. So that'll be good.
Perfect. So right now I'm working on getting this master's degree.
Yes.
And at the same time, I have this story for Latisse Knowles rumbling around in my head. So I'm going to go back to my Carey family and discuss that.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I just love all the ways that family intersects with Elizabeth in really fascinating and important ways. So that's very exciting to know that that's rumbling in your head. That's a great quote. Yeah. That's great. Well, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a real treat. And as I said, I'll have all the links and the books and links to that in the show notes. But I just so appreciate your speaking with us and helping us just really peek behind the scenes. Some of these stories we thought we knew and maybe didn't know as well as we thought. And that's what your books really do. I think they just give us a bright new spotlight on some of these times. And I really appreciate that. So thank you so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Hope you're all having a great summer. And stay tuned. There's lots more fun happening this month. And keep up shaking up history with all of us. Thank you so much.